Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so let's begin. Welcome to a new semester of Torah in Motion's course on my continuing now. I think it's in the 7th year classes on Great Rabbinic Figures. I know that the email that went out said Rav Avadya Yosef, and we will get to him. But I do have one more class to do, finish up from last semester of Elchanan Wasserman. This is going to tie in length all the other. The longest course up until now, which was, I believe it was Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski, who was also 8 classes, or maybe Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, I can't remember. One of them was 8 classes, and this is the 8th class on Rav Elchanan Wasserman. So without any further ado, let me begin right away. Before I do, just couple things to get out of the way. If you recall in the classes on the Ben Ish Chai, we spoke about how there's a grave for him in Jerusalem, even though he never was in Jerusalem and he never made it to Jerusalem. And some people believe that somehow he was magically transported to Jerusalem. That explains why there is a grave. And I mentioned similar examples of Moroccan rabbis. Subsequent to the class, I found that there's a Hasidic Rebbe named the Rebbe of Apta, Rav Avraham Yehoshua Heschel, who dies in 1825. I see this on Wikipedia. I saw it in a sefer, and then lo and behold, it's in Wikipedia as well. That although he's buried near the Baal Shem Tov, there's an ornate stone ohel marking his grave. No, sorry, that's the ornate stone ohel, but. He also has a grave in Tveria. So the story is that angels carried his body and buried him there. The other thing I want to call your attention to before we begin, this relates to Rav Elchanan Wasserman, is this book, which just came out recently. Ksor Chalamish, it's the Golden Age of Lithuanian Yeshivas in Eastern Europe. This book covers all the yeshivas in Eastern Europe between World War I and World War II, and it includes Baranovich as well, where Rav Elchanan Wasserman was Rosh Yeshiva. I mentioned last semester that although people think of him as one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, and he was, of course, very respected and an important leader, his yeshiva, however, was not a great yeshiva. His yeshiva was more of a high school place, a mechina. Almost to prepare students for the great yeshivas. And I showed you pictures, at least I showed you a picture, and you could see the kids were like 15, 16 years old. In this book, on page 391, he actually has, we have a lot of records of these yeshivas because of the Vade Yeshivos that's found in Yivo. They would send, they would get money from the Vade Yeshivos. A lot of this money would come, a lot of the records are now kept in New York, and money was sent from New York, and the yeshivas had to provide records about their students, how many, their ages. And we have here records from 1927 and 1936. And 30% of the students in 1927 are 16 years old. More than 25% of the students are 15 years old. 20% of the students are 17 years old, and then you have about 14% who are 18 years old. And the figures are the same basically in 1936. So, unlike the great yeshivas that would have 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23-year-olds and higher even, the Baranovich Yeshiva had no one over 22, and it had like 1% at that small number. So, it really was, as I mentioned, a yeshiva designed for people. To prepare to then go on to the great yeshivas, even though Rav Elchanan Wasserman himself was at this yeshiva, he could have just as easily been at one of the great yeshivas. The reason that people assume that Baranovich is one of the great yeshivas is precisely because of the figure of Rav Elchanan. Okay, everyone, let us now begin. The book, by the way, is the author's name is Ben Sion Klebanski. I want to just read you in the time we have remaining dealing with Rav Elchanan, and that's today. I'm going to finish it today. I just want to fill in a few things that I never got to. Interesting things he said. a couple points that were subject to dispute, the most famous story perhaps about Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. And so this last class today is really tidying up these loose ends, which I wasn't able to get to last semester. If you look in the Kovetz, which is the collected writings of Rabbi Chanan, on page 42, you have some interesting things which I'll call your attention to. First, he quotes the Talmud in Kiddushin that says that it speaks about, it mentions that someone is great, knowledgeable in all aspects of Torah. And the question is to him, therefore he's asked, you don't know how to then make a Kal V'chomer? Kal V'chomer, you know, say if you can do this on Yom Tov, certainly you can do it on, if you do it on Shabbos, certainly you can do it on Yom Tov. You know, from the major to the minor. That's what it says in the Talmud, in Kiddushin 10b. What Rabbi Chanan quotes Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik saying is, he says, what does Kal V'chomer have to do with having knowledge in Torah? Apparently, a Kal V'chomer is something anyone could have. And he quotes Rabbi Chaim as saying that it's not true. It could be that even a Kal V'chomer has to do with something that's with Torah knowledge. And in other words, he explains that this idea that people often assume that anyone could do a Kal V'chomer is incorrect. Then he continues on this page, and he points out there's a famous passage in the Gemara that says, people don't know what to make of this passage. It's so unusual. This is Kiddushin 40a. It says if someone sees that his Yetzer Hara, his evil inclination, is overpowering him, it refers to sexual matters, go to a place where no one knows you, dress in black, and do what you want to do, but don't, make a Chilul Hashem. This was referring, of course, to great rabbis. The average person doesn't make a Chilul Hashem what he does. And I've mentioned on numerous occasions that the Talmud is a work written by rabbis for rabbis. What we have today, that everyone will be studying the Talmud, Daf Yomi, everything, that was unimaginable to them. And there are certain stories there which are inside stories in which the rabbis don't come out looking very good. But that's okay because that's one rabbi telling another rabbi. The problem is when all of people like us see the text. So this is an interesting story. And I personally don't find it so strange, although many of the commentaries don't know what to make of it. It's not saying you should do this. It's saying that if someone's set on his ways and is going to do this, if you're going to do it, at least make sure you don't make a Chilul Hashem, because if a rabbi was caught doing something like that, then of course we have plenty of examples of that sort of thing. Rabbi Elchanan raises what he thinks is a good question. He quotes the Rif and the Rush, who say that we don't accept this position, which is said in the name of Rabbi Eli. Why don't we? Because it says elsewhere, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz b'yirat shamayim, that everything is in our hands except for fear of God. In other words, what this means is that we have free will. We can do what we want. Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven. That's what I meant to say. That is, if it rains and all these things, chutz b'yirat shamayim, everything relating to our free will. So this would appear to contradict the earlier passage in Kiddushin. So he quotes the Rif and the Rasha saying, most commentaries don't see it as a contradiction at all. The passage in Kiddushin is not denying free will. It's simply someone who is acknowledging that he's too weak, or he's not going to live up to what he should, that he should go somewhere else. But they see it as a contradiction. That Rabbi Lai says that there are times when you physically cannot control yourself. That is, you don't have free will. And Rabbi Chanan says this is very hard to accept, this assumption, which he sees the Rush and the Rif as holding, because the whole Torah depends on the idea of free will. So he says something interesting, however. He says, nevertheless, according to this view of the Rif and the Rush, that there are some times that you literally don't have free will. I mean, it's so overpowering. I think what the Rif would be saying is not that God removes your free will, but it's so overpowering that you don't have free will. Perhaps, modern psychology would agree with that. He says that the Rambam in his letters mentions that there, it says in the Talmud, 40 days before you're born, a heavenly voice goes out and says that this is who you're going to marry. Bashert. There's a Talmudic passage that says that everyone has someone who they're set to marry. And the Rambam, in one of his letters, says that this is not true. He rejects this idea. And what Rabbi Chanan says, that how could the Rambam go against the Gemara? And he answers that, no, it makes sense, because the Rambam will go like Rav Eloi, that in certain places that... No, the Rambam will go like the... will not go like Rav Eloi, will go with the other position, that we have free will. The Rambam will say that this Gemara that says that it's determined you're going to marry, that's in line with the position of like Rav Eloi. That, sometimes you don't have free will. And that's, I just mentioned this because it's an interesting point. You could obviously explain this differently. Page 56, he makes a point which I don't think is that anyone's going to find it surprising, but it's of interest anyway. The Rambam says that anyone could be a great tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. Anyone could be that. Even though the Torah says, Lokam Kamosha, no one else is going to, exist at the level of Moses, what does the Rambam think that means? That it's nevuah, prophecy. But in terms of righteousness, anyone could reach the level of Moshe. But Rabbi Chanan sees this as a problem. How could anyone reach the level of Moshe? You say that you're going to be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu? And he explains that, he cites some proofs, that it doesn't mean that you'll absolutely be a tzaddik like Moshe. That is, in an objective sense, you won't reach Moshe's level. However, in a subjective sense, you will. That is, you, at the level you are, as an average person, what you will achieve for you is the equivalent of what Moshe could achieve for Moshe. That is, God will judge it this way. But it's not in an objective sense that you reach the level of Moshe. It's like the famous Hasidic story where they say that, the Hasidic Rebbe is nervous when he's about to die. And the Hasidim are, they don't understand, why are you nervous? You live such a good life. And he says, when I get to the next world, I'm not afraid that they're going to ask me why you couldn't be like Moshe Rabbeinu. If they ask me why you couldn't be like Moshe Rabbeinu, I'll say, because you didn't make me like Moshe Rabbeinu. If they ask me why I wasn't such a tzaddik like Rabbi Akiva, I'll say, well, you didn't make me like Rabbi Akiva. But the question he says I'm worried about is, they say, why couldn't you be like Reb Zusha? That's who he is. And then what can I answer? Because you made me as Reb Zusha, but I didn't live up to what I could live up to. So that's what Rabbi Chanan says. And then he continues. Yes, well, Reb Zusha. Then he continues. And... he raises what he thinks is a question, but I don't see it as a question. He says one of the Rambam's 13 principles are that you have to believe that Moses is the greatest prophet. And then we have a problem, or he has a problem, because Miriam, if you recall, Miriam spoke about, according to the Rambam says that Miriam spoke Lashon Hara about her brother. She compared him to all the other prophets. And Rabbi Chanan says, are we supposed to say then that Miriam has left the Jewish people because she denies the Rambam's principles? And Rabbi Chanan says, I think what most people would say, that when Miriam said this, it wasn't yet a principle. It hadn't yet been established as a principle of faith. In fact, the Pasuk hadn't even been said that no one will rise like Moshe, or that Moshe is the only one I spoke to mouth to mouth. All Rabbi Chanan is saying is that the principles of faith, they go forward. That was, once they're established, from that point on, then they take effect. But they don't take effect going backwards. And finally, from the Kovetzig wrote, one final passage. He responds to someone who says, who criticized him, that he was too extreme. And he basically defends the idea of this extremism that, like Barry Goldwater said. That you're supposed to not be tolerance is not always a virtue. depends who you're being tolerant of. And that's a very important point. I don't think anyone disagrees in general, but I mention this only because with Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, it became a big dispute. Now, Shlomo says, why do I think it's not a question? You're saying about with the Miriam situation? Because obviously, for example, you believe in the Torah. Until the Torah is given, there's no ikar to believe in the Torah. So you couldn't take someone like Noach and say he doesn't believe in the Torah. I mean, therefore, he has no share in the world to come. There wasn't yet a Torah. That's my point. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman was one of the people asked by Rav Shimon Schwab his famous question. In previous classes, we've discussed this question. I briefly spoke about it. We talk in a little more detail now. Rav Shimon Schwab, who most people know him as the rabbi of Washington Heights, the community, the Hirshian community in Washington Heights. In fact, if you follow the blogs, you'll know that there's a big dispute going on in Washington Heights right now because a group of people in Washington Heights just put out a machzor in accordance with the old German practice, and the rabbi of Washington Heights, for some reason, didn't like it. He told him not to, and they did it. I don't understand why the rabbi's so upset. If he doesn't want to use it, he doesn't have to use it. But last Shabbos, he attacked these people from the pulpit. And they published this drasha of his online. And I have to say, some of the things this rabbi says, I mean, he mocks them for, being careful with their English. When they write, their English commentary they have there. Every time they mention Christians, they're careful to capitalize Christians with a C. I mean, that's supposed to be a problem. And he says all sorts of other things that against them. And as I said, and the irony is that one of the people involved with this is this guy Gordimer. So if you know the blogs, Gordimer is always attacking people that he doesn't like. And he's involved with this sitter to a certain, his machzor, because his son's the editor. And so a lot of people are finding this ironic. The truth of the matter is this has an approbation from Rabbi Binyamin Shlomo Hamburger, who's the world's expert really in German practices and minhagim. It has a letter from Ravari Folger, who was just appointed the rabbi of Vienna, and it appears to be a wonderful machzor, and the rabbi's all upset because we don't say some of these piyutim, why are you putting them in? Again, I say, big deal. First of all, it's not just for that community, it could be for any community, and just because you don't say anything, Art Scroll puts a lot of things in the Siddur we don't say. Some people might want to say it or look at it. I think the key to this is that the rabbi says in his drasha that people were disrespectful because he asked them not to publish this, and they went ahead and did it anyway. So I don't know what the politics of that are. But in any event, the rabbi today and the previous rabbi, they're not really German rabbis, although they've served German communities. This rabbi, I believe, was in Switzerland. They don't come from a good, yucky German stock. Rabbi Schwab was the last such rabbi. And when he served in Washington Heights, he was a Hirshian. He was a Torah im Derech Eretz rabbi, and he was a complete Hirshian. Because not only was he Torim Derech Eretz, he had no good feelings for Yeshiva University or Zionism. I mean, he really followed the old Hirshian path. On the other hand, when he was younger, he wasn't such a Hirshian. He went and he studied in Eastern Europe. He was exposed to the Yeshiva world's mentality. And when he came back and started serving as a rabbi in Germany, in a small town outside of Frankfurt, he wrote a book claiming that you shouldn't adopt the Hirshian approach anymore because it was only an emergency measure, no longer applicable, and that we should only be Torah-only Jews. And I think, by the way, Washington Heights today is completely yeshivish. I think the only thing that remains of the old German Orthodox approach is the nusach, the liturgy. There's no real conception anymore of Torah Derech Eretz. Later, Rabbi Schwab came to regret what he wrote, and he even wrote a book called These and Those, in which he explained that there are two equally valid approaches in traditional Judaism, the approach of the yeshiva world and the Hirshian approach, which believes that you have to be a part of Western civilization. He also published a letter, first published anonymously, later it was revealed who it was, actually attacking the yeshiva world's stress that the only thing that matters is producing great Torah sages, and pointing out that lay people are also important, and that should be a goal. And that, again, is the Hirshian approach. Well, when he comes back to Germany in the mid-30s, in addition to writing this book in opposition to Torim Derech Eretz, he sends a letter. He sends letters to a number of great Torah sages. Many of them didn't reply to the letter. We know, for instance, that the Ger Rebbe refused to reply to this letter. The letter asked them, is Torim Derech Eretz, the Hirshian method, still applicable today? And the Ger Rebbe, for instance, said that although it's not our approach, who am I to criticize Shimshon Raphael Hirsch? But we have letters from Rabbi Blachov Tells, the Rugachover, a few other people, explaining, you know, the question was, in today's day and age, is there still room to adopt this approach of Torim Derech Eretz, Torah and Western civilization? And he also threw in how German Orthodox Jews, they like to go to the theater and all sorts of things. Basically, he was trying to get rabbinic support for overturning this German Orthodox lifestyle, say, it's not applicable anymore, it was applicable once, but now we don't need it, etc. One of the people he wrote to was Rav Elchanan Wasserman. In the, I mentioned last class how, I mean last semester, how for some reason Rabbi Rakefet gets this all wrong. He thinks that the letter Rabbi Hanan's responding to is from Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz in America. But no, it's Rabbi Schwab. And in fact, in this book here, which we printed, it has footnotes, it claims that Rabbi Schwab was a student of Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, which is not correct, but... he did ask Rabbi Hanan Wasserman as one of the great sages. Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, in his reply, says that it is permitted to study secular pursuits, secular subjects, but only to make a living, and only if you're not going to be reading heretical material. We mentioned last semester how Rabbi Hanan was in America. He even refused to give a shiur at Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan Yeshiva College because in the library there they have heretical material. He says as follows. He says other interesting points as well. He says that in your country, that is Germany, the big problem is that you think that secular studies, he calls them limudim chitzonim, are like Torah. That is, you learn it for its own sake. That is, you want to be a more complete person. You read literature because it has independent value. And he says that no, only Torah is studied for its own sake. Anything else you're studying has to be for utilitarian reasons. Now, this doesn't mean Rabbi Hanan would say you can't read, let's say, Shakespeare or something like that. But the point of reading it would be if you're tired of learning after a long day and you want to relax, okay, you can read something. Some people will read light reading. Other people might read Shakespeare. But the idea that, you know, the Hirshian idea that you read Shakespeare and Schiller and Goethe and that makes you a more complete person and that... you know, is what it means to be a mensch, a human being in the world, that you have to be conversant with the great achievements of civilization, that Rabbi Hanan completely rejects, and he stresses that Torah study has to be superior and everything else has to be below it. Then he says that, we spoke about this already, that all this trying to study these things, you think this is going to make the non-Jews like you. On the contrary, this will lead to more anti-Semitism. And then he says on page 93 that we are fortunate today. We've seen a new breath of fresh air coming into Germany. I discussed this in my book on Rabbi Weinberg in chapter 6. That is, the young German Orthodox Jews, because they're Ruach Tahara, they want to go back to the old path. Namely, Torah only. And that's a wonderful thing, and he says. And the truth is that you had a whole group of German Orthodox young people studying in the great yeshivas in Eastern Europe. And Rabbi Hanan says the first thing to do in Germany to fix this is to make sure that until now, he says, every community would insist that the rabbis they hired would have to be doctors, rabbiner doctors. The Reform rabbis were all rabbiner doctors, so the Orthodox felt that they had to be their level as well. And Rabbi Hanan says, from now on, don't request this. Instead, kohamar bebetar v'yir shemay meshubach. Anyone who has more Torah and fear of heaven is meshubach, is praiseworthy. V'lo hamar bebephilosophia. Not someone who has a lot of philosophical knowledge. So that's his recommendation. And then he gets to the other thing that Rabbi Schwab asked him. Halicha l'teatrot, going to the theaters. German Orthodox Jews would go to the opera, they'd go to the theaters, and that to them was a part of culture. And Rabbi Hanan says, of course, this is forbidden. We're not supposed to be involved in the same sort of pleasures as the Gentiles. In addition, he says there are some times when these plays are sensual and you're not allowed to go see those things. And he says in earlier generations, Jews knew to keep apart from this. And finally, he quotes Rabbi Schwab, who says, Rabbi Schwab admitted in his letter that there seems to be a dispute about secular studies and philosophy in particular. Some rabbis in the past supported it. I mean, you talk about medievals, you have the Rambam, etc., and others opposed it. And Rabbi Hanan is not a revisionist. He says, you're absolutely right. This was a great dispute in earlier days. And he quotes the Cholos Levavos, who says that the only way you can know God is through, to be connected to God is through knowledge. And that's through philosophy. And then he quotes the opponents of this, who say that you're supposed to connect to the Torah not through what we call chakira, investigation, but simple belief. But then Rabbi Hanan says that today there's no dispute. And everyone would disagree with the Chovos Levavos and agree with the other side, because he says, even according to the Chovos Levavos, the Rambam, the Ralbag, etc., all those great figures in medieval times, the Meiri, the list is endless. The entire school in the Arab world, in Provence, in Spain, all of them thought that you're supposed to study philosophy, and emuna has to be something that intellectually achieved, not simply because, as the other, it's a Kabbalah me'ha'avot, it's received, simple belief. He says that all those great figures would only permit the study of philosophy when there's no chance of danger, that is, of people being turned to irreligiosity. And who were you referring to? Those people who filled, as he says, their bellies with Torah and Yirat Shemayim, like the Rambam says, they are permitted to study. However, Rabbi Hanan says, this is not what's happening in Germany. In Germany, what's happening there? Even a boy, you're going to say that even a 13-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl who are required, by the way, to, in mitzvot in its entirety, are you going to say that they're old enough that, are you going to say that the Torah will permit them to study these secular subjects? In other words, according to the philosophical approach, the Rambam, Rabachia, etc., emunah is a mitzvah. And how do you fulfill the mitzvah? You fulfill the mitzvah through chakira, through philosophical knowledge. And Rabbi Hanan says, and everyone is responsible for this, 12-year-old girls and 13-year-old boys, they're obligated to mitzvot. Rabbi Hanan says, can you imagine that the Torah would obligate a 13-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl to study philosophy? It's certainly going to be damaging for them. So that's his great proof, first of all, that we don't hold like the Rambam and Rabachia, because it doesn't work. Maybe it worked in the olden days, but it doesn't work today. And he says that even they would agree that today it would cause damage, because if you're going to say, if you're going to adopt the Rambam's position, that belief has to be knowledge, and emunah, which is one of the mitzvot, actually, the Rambam doesn't even count it as a moon. He says one of the mitzvot is you have to know about God. Well, obviously, a 13-year-old boy and 12-year-old girl are obligated in this, which means that we have to start teaching them philosophy and things of that nature. Rabbi Hanan says it's obvious you can't do something like that. They're not at that level. At the very least, only people who fill their belly with Torah and Yirat Shemayim can achieve these things. And therefore, he says that we don't adopt this approach, and there's no reason to go to the university and study philosophy, etc. It happens to be a good question on the Rambam, but the Rambam's answer is clear, that there's different levels of emunah. For a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, you start basic, and then you move up. And it's not just 12, 13-year-olds. Some people will never advance to be able to achieve real heights of emunah because they won't have any academic intellectual knowledge. And that is precisely the reason why many think, including the Brisker Rav, Julius Gutman, and others, for the 13 principles, to make sure that even the simple people, and even the 12-year-old and the 13-year-old, has certain basic knowledge. And then as they move on, they learn more and more. But according to this approach, the Rambam would say that you do fulfill the mitzvah of understanding God at age of 12 and 13. It's just in a very basic way. As for the other point, perhaps the Rambam would agree that if you're in an era when it's dangerous, you don't teach the people. In his Kovetz Shiurim, Rabbi Chanan's volume of his collected, it's called Kovetz Shiurim. It's commentary, I guess you could say, on the Talmud. On Bava Basra, number 633, I found something quite interesting. He quotes Rav Chaim Soloveitchik as saying that an Amora, one of the people who wrote the Talmud, actually has the power to dispute with a Tana, one of the people who wrote the Mishnah. Generally, they didn't do so, but technically, they did have the authority to do so if they wanted to. Rabbi Chanan, his concern is, and Rabbi Chaim's concern is, what do you mean when you say that Amoraim don't dispute with Tanaim? Why not? What's the mechanism which says that they can't? I mean, it's not like there was a decree from Chazal stating as much. So therefore, what Chaim says is that in theory they could if they want to, but in practice they didn't. In other words, there was a minhag, a practice among the Maharaim not to dispute with them, but there were some who did. And that's when the Talmud says Tana Ufalig, that these early Amoraim could still dispute. Now, I don't know if Reb Chaim applies this also to after the Talmud. That is, can one of the Gaonim or one of the medieval authorities, is he allowed to dispute with the Talmud? Reb Chanan doesn't tell us what Reb Chaim says, but Reb Chanan himself did think so, at least theoretically. Reb Chanan says, not an individual. However, he says if the majority of sages today, even, he's talking about contemporary sages, were to get together and agree on something, it would have the status of a Sanhedrin. Even though they don't have smicha, if the sages come together and agree on something, it's as if they have this old-fashioned smicha, and they could reject what appears in the Talmud. I mean, the Rambam says it as well, but the Rambam is speaking about people who have a smicha based in later based in Haggadah. Rabbi Chanan says even contemporary sages could do that. Now, when Rabbi Chanan wrote this, this was a theoretical point. Again, he's trying to figure out the mechanism and how is it that we don't argue and what's the status of all the sages together. There's a various halachot which passages in the Talmud which can be explained by ideas such as this. However, when the Chazon Ish saw what Rabbi Chanan wrote, which again was totally theoretical, he wrote to Rabbi Chanan very sharply and said, it's forbidden to hear such a thing. That is, that contemporary rabbis could have the status of a Sanhedrin and could reject what appears in the Talmud. The Chazon Ish assumes that there's no decision, Rabbi Chanan assumes there was no decision by the post-Talmudic authorities not to dispute with the Talmud. There simply was a recognition that they're not at their level. No, sorry, the Chazon Ish says that. The Chazon Ish says that the later authorities recognize that they're not at their level, and therefore, for inherent reasons, they can't dispute with the Talmud because they're not at that level. But Rabbi Chanan doesn't see this, and he responds to the Chazon Ish stating that he agrees with him, and he's just speaking theoretically, and he never intended that actually today anyone would disagree with the Talmud. Our sages today, he says, are so far removed from the Talmudic sages. However, he says that in theory it's possible, and there are exceptions. And this explains why, how earlier, for example, Amoraim could dispute. So we see that Rabbi Chanan is quick to discount the practical implications of what he wrote. Although, if you read what he wrote, you can see why the Chazon Ish came to this conclusion. Now, Binyamin Brown, the great Binyamin Brown, who wrote the long book on the Chazon Ish as well as other things, he states that in his opinion, Rabbi Chanan didn't realize that when he wrote this, the radical implications of what he was saying. He was just writing theoretically, and it took the Chazon Ish to call attention to it. In fact, in his doctoral dissertation, it doesn't appear in his book, but in his doctoral dissertation, He says that it's difficult not to see this as a dispute relating to the reality. You know, the Chazon Ish is in the land of Israel, and there's a lot of concern about the chief rabbinate. You know, what are they going to do? Are they going to become like a Sanhedrin, etc.? And therefore, the Chazon Ish is responding to anything that could even move in that direction. Elsewhere, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, in his Divrei Sofrim, discusses why you're obligated to follow the rabbinic laws. We all know that there are rabbinic laws. Well, who says I have to follow the rabbinic laws? Again, he's thinking, he's explaining the theory behind all this. We have a Torah, we know what the origin of the Torah is, and it binds us. And then the rabbis come along and they require certain things. What gives the rabbis the right to require these things? What requires me to listen to the rabbis? Maybe it's not an obligation, it's just an option. If I want to, I can. But of course, it is an obligation. So, well, where is the requirement? He quotes Nachmanides that the obligation to follow the rabbis is not a Torah obligation. Others think that the Torah gives authority to the rabbis. That raises a different problem because if you follow the rabbis because the Torah says so, then every time you violate a rabbinic prohibition, you're violating a Torah prohibition. But Nachmanides doesn't say that. At least Rabbi Chanan's interpretation is that Nachmanides holds, the Ramban, that Chazal, there's a certain sort of mystical involvement here, that when Chazal say something, the sages say something, this is in agreement with God's intent. That is, if the sages explain a certain passage in the Talmud, this is in agreement with God's intent. And if there's a dispute, well, both sides are in agreement with God's intent, and then we'll come to a conclusion. But since it's not stated in the Torah directly, this is of less importance than a law stated directly in the Torah. So therefore, if you have a Torah law overrides a rabbinic law. But still, we follow the rabbinic laws because this is God's intent. Not that there's a special law in the Torah, one of the 613, and we have to follow the rabbis. Rather, that we believe that the rabbis are the best, are giving us God's intent. Maybe Nachmanides would say to the best of their ability. Now, the Meshech Chochma, by the way, does say that there's a commandment to follow the sages. But he doesn't say that this means that the particulars are the will of God. He doesn't go that far. Now, Rav Shlomo Fischer, great sage in Jerusalem, he has a whole thing. If you're interested in this further, in his great sefer called the Beit Yishai, in number 15, he has a whole section dealing with it's called Inyan Kabbalat HaRabim, the whole idea when the community as a whole accepts something, and he discusses Rabbi Chanan Wasserman's views. He quotes, for example, the Kesef Mishnah. The Kesef Mishnah asked the same question. Why didn't the, that we saw before, why didn't the Amoraim disagree with the Tanaim? We saw the Reb Chaim Soloveitchik says that they took upon themselves, that in theory they could, but they chose not to. And that's basically what the Kesef Mishnah says, that the later generations took upon themselves not to dispute with them. And then he quotes Rabbi Chanan, who asks, well, what does this mean, they took upon themselves not to dispute with them? And Rabbi Chanan says, it appears that when the Talmud was closed, there was a kibbutz kol chachmei Yisrael, that all the sages got together and declared that you know, you can't dispute anymore. And Rabbi Shlomo Fischer says, Eini yodea mi yigoro razeh shekach hayamaaseh. Rabbi Shlomo Fischer says, who told Rabbi Chanan that this happened? That is, that you know, the sages actually got together and said that we're not going to. He says that we have to assume like the Kesef Mishnah. He quotes Shlomo Fischer on this page in the note, quotes Rabbeinu Yonah, who says that there was an agreement from one sage to the other, to accept, you know, from generation to generation, to accept the oral tradition. And then he says at the end of the Talmudic period, they agreed that nothing should be added to the Talmud. And what did Shlomo Fischer say? He says, this, I don't understand this at all. How could he say this? Because we know that he says, Hu davar muchash mikol rishonim. He says, what Rabbeinu Yonah says, that at the end of the Talmud, they decreed or they made an agreement, nothing more to be added to the Torah. He says this is contradicted by all the Rishonim. What does he mean by that? Because all the Rishonim point out that there are many things that were added to the Talmud from the Rabbanan Savarai. If you follow Halivni's approach, the whole Shakla Vatarya, back and forth disputes in the Talmud, are added by the post-Talmudic authorities. So Rav Shlomo Fisher says he doesn't understand how Rabbeinu Yonah could say this. I mean, you can't say that Rabbeinu Yonah maybe didn't know this. It's not like some yeshiva student today who maybe has only studied some tractates of Talmud who doesn't realize that there's additions to it. Rabbeinu Yonah was one of the most important medieval authorities. He also knew that there were passages added. He doesn't give an answer here. He just leaves as it's Sarachiyun. Needs to be investigated. I think maybe Rabbeinu Yonah is speaking about Jewish laws, or maybe he's just speaking in generalities. When I said before about the later generations, even a contemporary generation can override what appears, let's say, in the Talmud, if we're together as a group, the Rambam says, right at the beginning of Hilchos Mamrim, that if you have a contemporary Sanhedrin, they can override what it appears an earlier based in, and that would apply to the Talmud as well, something that was derived at from a drasha, that is, where they derived it from the verses. So, for instance, we know that women are not included as witnesses in various things. They derive it from a verse. A contemporary Beit Din Hagadol, contemporary Sanhedrin, could give a different drasha. The novelty of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman is he's saying that even without smicha, normally we assume that you need smicha if everyone gets together, unanimous or maybe almost unanimous. The question is, does it only have to be in the land of Israel or not? They would have the authority and would be able to override certain things. This also is problematic from political reasons because at the beginning of the state, there was this great fear that they would do exactly that, that rabbis would get together, create like a Beis Din HaGadol. In fact, you can follow the position of Mari Beirav, Jacob Beirav of Tzfat, and you can reinstitute the Sanhedrin. And the fear was that then you'd have rabbis abolishing halachot in the name of the Sanhedrin. A couple more things. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman quotes Reb Chaim as saying something very interesting. People who study Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Brisker method, you always ask yourself, is this the original intent? Is this what they meant? And Rabbi Chanan says that according to Reb Chaim, although there were novel elements in their approach, what they believed they were doing is revealing that which is latent in the sources. And that's what Reb Chaim means. Rabbi Chanan quotes Reb Chaim as saying that our job is not to create new chidushim. Our job is merely to understand the words of the Rishonim, the medieval authorities, and the Talmud. That is, everything we do, which you might call a chidush, a novel, is really just showing you what the earlier sages said. And, I mean, it's said that the Beis Halevi, the father of Chaim, who was born, as it were, before Matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah of Chaim, he said that it used to be that when I think this is what he said, I forget the exact language, it used to be when someone asked a good question, I'd be happy and the questioner would be happy because it's a good question and I have to give a good answer. But when you'd ask that question to Reb Chaim, he'd explain to you the different positions of each authority, and it shows you there's no question there to begin with. That is, our job is not to answer. Our job is not to answer for the Rambam. Again, the Raivad asks a kasha, a difficulty on the Rambam. So traditionally, what do? You come up with a chidush, a novel idea to explain, to answer the question of the Raivad. For Reb Chaim, you're not interested in answering the Raivad. You're not answering and justifying the Rambam says in the face of the Rambam. Your job is to explain the different positions so you understand what the Rambam's view is, where it came from, and what the Raivad's view is, and then you understand why the Raivad came to his conclusion and why the Rambam came to his conclusion. But it's not about answering questions. It's about illuminating each of their thought processes. And Reb Chaim Rabbi Chanan says Rabbi Chaim insisted that he's not writing Chidushim. He's simply studying the early sources in a way that they appear in a new light, but that's bringing out that which is already there, removing the veil upon the halach, from upon the halacha. That's the language that Joseph B. Soloveitchik used. Now I want to tell you a story. The most famous story of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. If you read the Art Scroll book, which I've showed you in the past, you won't see this story. It's a hagiographical book, but it has lots of good information. So in preparing for these classes last semester, I went through the book and I couldn't believe my eyes. The most famous story is not in the book. So then I picked up the Hebrew volume. Could it not be in the Hebrew volume? It's in the Hebrew volume. It's not in the English volume. That's the story of the Dibbuk, which I'm going to tell you now. I did some investigation, and it's reported that Rav Simcha Wasserman, the son of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, actually, this is mentioned by Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, gave I'll read it to you, actually. Rav Nosson Kamenetsky reports that Rav Simcha Wasserman told the Art Scroll when they published it not to print the story of the Dibbuk. But I'll tell you the whole story in a second. I can't find it now. I'll find it for you in a minute when I get to it. He doesn't say why. I think the reason's obvious, that it's not the sort of story that modern readers... he doesn't give the reason here. If you're interested in seeing it, it's Making of a Gadol. It's on page 673. He says that the Art Scroll book Rabbi Chanan omits any reference to the Dibbuk story. Oh, he says a check with the publishers. So he investigated himself, Kamenetsky. So what is this Dibbuk story? Which, as I said, is the most famous story. It's usually mentioned, it's usually described as the Dibbuk and the Chafetz Chaim. Rabbi Chanan, the Dibbuk, and the Chafetz Chaim, although the Chafetz Chaim really has no part in this whole story. Rabbi Chanan would tell this story every year, according to some sources. Other sources said he only told it very rarely. But there are sources that said he told it every year to strengthen people's faith in reward and punishment. And the text that's recorded in the Hebrew, Sorosky's biography, is from the text that Rabbi Chanan's youngest son copied word for word from Rabbi Chanan's own mouth. Now, as I said, Rabbi Nosson Kamenetsky, in this book, I have both of them, this one and also the so-called new and improved version. There's no difference in the two volumes, as far as I know, with the story I'm going to tell you now. Collector's item, by the way, although you can get online, I believe. Now it's available online if you just send Rabbi Kamenetsky $20. He discusses the whole story. There's a woman, young woman, and... she had a dibbuk inside of her, and Chafetz Chaim went to see her, and Rabbi Chanan, and they figured out they wanted to get rid of the dibbuk, and they said when they say Kaddish, the dibbuk will come out of her. A possession story. It's not like the dibbuk knew who the Chafetz Chaim was. She said he's like a Tana, you know, he's that great. But you don't have any crazy stuff in this story, like a typical dibbuk story, where you walk in and the dibbuk starts telling you things. About your past life, about your life, secret things that no one else knew. None of that stuff. In fact, at the end of the day, the story is not that interesting a story, the Dibbuk. The Dibbuk doesn't do crazy. The head doesn't turn around, and it doesn't levitate, or any of the things you'd expect a Dibbuk to do. Doesn't know secrets or anything like it. On pages 678 to 680, he discusses the story, and... he tells us that the Chafetz Chaim's family made short shrift of the story. He tells us about various members of the family who denied the whole story, how the son-in-law of Mendel Zaks scoffed at it. He quoted someone else who asked Rav Mendel Zaks, and Rav Mendel Zaks wouldn't talk about it, thinking it's nonsensical, etc., etc. So here, Kamenetsky, in two pages, after reciting the story that came from Rabbi Yochanan, quotes all these people who say that the story never happened. And I'm talking about people in the yeshiva world. Then he says, and this is the sort of thing that could get the book banned, on page 680, he quotes Rav Yosef Kahaneman, the Ponevezer Rosh Yeshiva, as stating that the reason why Rav Yochanan was convinced that he was dealing with a dibbuk instead of a mentally ill woman, this was ascribed by Rav Kahaneman to naivete, to mimus. So here you have Nassim Kamenetsky quoting Rav Kahaneman as saying that, you know, Rav Yochanan wasn't so sophisticated in this matter. He fell for something which, you know, he should have seen through. There's a mentally ill woman, and he thought that this was some sort of possession. And as I said, Rav Mendel Zaks and others, Rav Shlomo Wolber reported that Rav Yerucham Lavovitz, who played a part in this story, held that it was no dibbuk, rather she was suffering from mental illness, etc., etc. And he goes on and on. So after you read this famous story of the Chafetz Chaim in the dibbuk and Rabbi Yochanan, it pulls the legs out from under it, because on the one hand you have Rabbi Yochanan reporting such a story, on the other hand you have all these figures saying that this is nonsensical. Of course, if you're a rationalist and you don't believe in dibbuks at all, this would have been your conclusion anyway. But here you have great rabbis saying the same thing and disagreeing with Rabbi Yochanan. This is one of the contributions of Making of a Gadol. Until Making of a Gadol, there was only one version of the story. I never heard anything about that. Mental illness, you just had to assume that if you don't accept dibbuks, that you don't accept it. But the idea, everyone assumed, as far as I knew, that you know, this was held by the Chafetz Chaim and others. And if you read Kamenetsky, you get a completely different portrayal, that it's Rabbi Yochanan who's really, as we call it, Das Yachid, in seeing this as some sort of possession, and everyone else just a mental illness. Because of, and now to conclude with Rabbi Yochanan, one more interesting point. The Kovetz Ha'aros, he says something. I don't know if there's any earlier sources for it, but he says that the reason they've been the blood libel for so many years throughout Jewish history, this is a punishment for the sin of Joseph's brothers dipping the coat of many colors or whatever type of coat that was into blood and bringing it to their father. So it's what we call a midah keneged midah. I always thought that was an interesting interpretation. Let me conclude by saying that you know, we've had 8 classes on Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. It took 8 classes because he is one of the most interesting and, I guess you would say, controversial figures. In his lifetime, he was universally admired for his piety and his learning. On the other hand, there was a lot of opposition to his views. His views were regarded as extreme in Lithuania. Obviously, the Mizrahi people regarded his views as extreme. He was martyred, so in that sense, generally you don't have disputes anymore about him in the way you would have if he didn't have that unfortunate end. But for those who know, and those who read his writings, you see that there's a lack of comfort with some of his ideas, even though he's a great sage. He's not like the Satmar Rav, where he's just totally not accepted in the Lithuanian world. He was part of the Lithuanian world. But there is this ambivalence about how to deal with him, as we saw even with his brother-in-law, Rabbi Chaim Ozer, who had big disagreements with him. But I never seen in my lifetime, in any of the yeshivas I've been to, and they've only been religious Zionist yeshivas, the ones I've attended, etc., anything but the utmost respect for Rabbi Yochanan. These views of his, the extreme views, are basically ignored. And this means that they were regarded as off-limits, and no other Chardali yeshiva would even dignify them with having them in the yeshiva library, various yeshivas. There's lots and lots of religious Zionist yeshivas. This is, if you would, the flip side of the Haredi position. The Haredi, the standard Haredi position, I'm not talking about Hungarians who won't read anything by Rav Kook, but the typical Lithuanian yeshiva position is that Rav Kook's halachic writings are okay, they're in. If you go to Lakewood, I saw it with my own eyes in the Otzer Sfar in the library, you have Rav Kook's halachic writings. However, his philosophical writings, his hashkafic writings, they're off limits, they're not allowed in. And I don't know, maybe some of you listening will see this as only appropriate. If the right wing can do it to the religious Zionist, and say that we're not even going to include Rav Kook's writings in their library, then why can't the religious Zionists say the same thing about Rabbi Chanan and say we're not going to include his writings in our library? I like to think, though, that the better approach is to have everyone's writings, even have the Satmar Rebbe's writings there. Just because you have someone's writings doesn't mean you agree with them, but you should be open-minded enough to read Rabbi Chanan's Hashkafa writings, to read his read the Satmar Rebbe's writings. First of all, it makes you a more understanding religious Zionist because you can see the arguments and understand how best to respond to them. And, you know, maybe you'll read something there and it'll change your mind. Only people who are afraid of changing their minds, people who are not real intellectuals, refrain from reading the writings of people they disagree with. Because if you're a real intellectual and if you really believe in truth, then you're willing to accept the fact that maybe you'll read someone else's writings and it'll change your mind. And who knows, maybe you'll read Rabbi Chanan and it'll change your mind. And if that's the case, then that's what it's meant to be. When I was in, I used to have a chavrusa in the Scranton Yeshiva in the evenings. And he knew a lot of Gemara. Didn't know that much about other things, but he knew a lot of Gemara. And one day he made a negative comment about Herzl. You know, well, of course he made Herzl. In the yeshiva world, they have negative comments. So I said to him, you know, why you make such a negative comment about Herzl? You know that some great rabbis thought very highly of Herzl. And he said, like who? So I said, Rav Avraham Eliel Kaplan. Avraham Eliel Kaplan, in the yeshiva world, to this day, although he dies young at age, I think it's 31, he preceded Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg as the head of the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. You know, he's a great, famous Telzer. They still sing his song. He wrote a song, which they sing at Shalashudis, a very poetic song. He was a brilliant person, and for his young years had a great impact in the yeshiva world. I said that he wrote an essay on Herzl, full of admiration. He even ends the essay and says, the closer I get to Torah, the more Zionistic I get. And the person didn't believe me. And I said, no, I mean it. So I make a copy of it. I bring it into him. And then the week after that, I said, so did you read Rav Avraham Kaplan, what he said about Herzl? And he said, no, I didn't read it. I said, what do you mean you didn't read it? I told you. He said, I can't read it. I said, why can't you read it? And what I'm going to tell you showed me the bad side of the yeshiva world, the anti-intellectualism. He said, I couldn't read it because we have a very negative, in our world, Herzl is someone that we're very opposed to. But we also accept Rav Avraham Eliel Kaplan. So if I read Rav Avraham Kaplan and see what he says about Herzl, that's a problem because, you know, we also reject Herzl. So I said to him, why is it a problem? Maybe you'll read Rav Avraham Kaplan and you'll see that you shouldn't reject Herzl, that you should see the good in it. But he couldn't understand that because it's like the machlokas of reason versus revelation. From revelation, he knows he has to hate Herzl, but reason, he knows he has to, you know, take seriously what Rav Avraham Kaplan says. So therefore he decides, well, I'm going to spare myself this crisis of faith, and I'd rather not read Avraham Eliel Kaplan, because I'd rather stay where I am now. That, to me, is a point of view I can't understand. So to what Ritzvi Yehuda Kook, by banning Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, I just would say that I don't think that that's the proper approach. The better approach, I said, is to read Rabbi Chanan, to be challenged by what he says, and hopefully not to be convinced by his arguments, because, as I said, his arguments are basically the Satmar arguments, and they were rejected by the mainstream Lithuanian rabbinate then, and I believe should be rejected as well today, but they're written in such a way that they might get you very angry reading them, but he is a great figure, and we shouldn't hide from what great figures have to say, even if that's not our own approach. I like to say that that's what makes us superior to others, is that we're willing to read the other side. I'll end with one final story and then take some questions. Basically, when I go to speak at shuls, it's not hard to find a topic, but I went to one shul, and the rabbi was very Haredi, even though the community wasn't, and and that's often not a problem at all, but in this particular case, the community wanted me to speak on Rav Goren. Rav Shlomo Goren, I have a talk on Rav Goren, and the rabbi vetoed it. He vetoed it because he doesn't like Rav Goren. And I couldn't understand this because I'm not coming to advocate Rav Goren. I'm coming to talk about his ideas, etc. And so the rabbi says, in explaining why in his shul Rav Goren's not appropriate, he says, well, would you speak on the Satmar Rav in your shul? He was trying to say, just you wouldn't speak on the Satmar Rav, so of course we won't speak on Rav Goren. And I said, of course I'd speak on the Satmar Rav. I gave like three or four classes on the Satmar Rav. I've spoken on the Satmar Rav at modern Orthodox shuls. And I said, that's the difference between us and you. That even though if we don't hold the Satmar Rav's position, we recognize he's a great scholar and a sage, and it's important for us to understand his position. Because just like in Halacha, we study both positions. We study Beit Shammai, even though Beit Shammai is rejected. So too, we should study all positions. And Rabbi Rakefet famously said that you can't be a good religious Zionist without knowing the Satmar Rav's Vayoa Moshe. So with that, we come to the end of 8 classes on Rabbi Hanan Wasserman. Believe me, I could have gone on for another 3 or 4. But it is time to move on, and we will start next class. And we'll can probably go for the rest of the semester with Rav Avadya Yosef. There he is. The middle years, from the time he comes back to Egypt, through the 1950s, the 1960s, and his growth as an important figure. I will now take some questions, and I hope it wasn't disappointing for those of you who thought that we were starting with Rav Avadya today, but it was a mistake, the email that was sent out. We will start with Rav Avadya next week, and I'm happy to take a few questions now about Rav Hanan Wasserman. If you read my last Sfarim blog post, or not the last one, the two before, I included a YouTube video there from this madman, Yosef Mizrahi, who says the craziest things, how he's even welcome in any Orthodox shul is beyond me. But one of the things he said in the video I posted was so religiously offensive, much more offensive than the things he's been attacked over. He said that that those rabbis who were killed in the Holocaust were killed because they weren't complete tzaddikim, and every real tzaddik escaped. I mean, it's really blasphemous to say things like this, not to mention stupid. But he said, what about Rabbi Hanan Wasserman? He said, well, Rabbi Hanan Wasserman went back to die. You know, that yeshiva legend I told you about, which is complete nonsense. And someone asks him, well, how is that permissible? And he says, he doesn't know. He says, maybe to give the people strength as they're going to die. Between last semester and this semester, I saw that Marvin Heyer, in his autobiography that just appeared, also repeats this thing, that Rabbi Hanan Wasserman went back to die. The strange thing, it's the strangest thing. Marvin Heyer is a very intelligent person. He knows that Rabbi Hanan went back in March of 39. So he writes that Rabbi Hanan went back in March of 39. He writes as if World War II is taking place. He describes Rabbi Hanan going back during wartime in March of 39. Now, Marvin Heyer knows that World War II was not taking place in March of 39. I had someone I know who knows him. You know, I passed this on, and he says, oh, it was a slip, and it'll be corrected if they reprint it. But, you know, it's a very strange thing. But he says it as well. So this is a legend. Shlomo says, to me, your answer to Rabbi Hanan's question sounded the same as Rabbi Hanan's answer. You know, I don't remember which answer. You're talking about Miriam? About Miriam being a prophetess? Yeah, but my point was, I don't think it's a question even that you have to answer. He makes it seem like it's a question. I think it's pretty obvious. That's all I said. So if you want to ask a question to answer it, that's one thing, but it's pretty obvious that before the principle is established, there's not a principle. In other words, it seems to me it's not such a great question that Rabbi Chana needs to ask. How could Miriam, does that mean Miriam's not part of the Jewish people? Or maybe it is a question. I don't know. It just appears to me that it wasn't such a difficult question. I'll wait 2 more minutes for any further questions. I didn't get a chance to speak about Rabbi Chanan Wasserman and some other aspects of his writings. In my book, the new book, I point out how certain things Rabbi Chanan said were censored when they appeared in Hebrew and English. He has a very patriarchal view of women and other things. You can get the details in my book. The Art Scroll book on Rav Ovadia, you're talking about the book by the guy from Toronto. Was that that's not Art Scroll though. No, I didn't see the Art Scroll book. There's a hagiography that just came out in English by the same guy who wrote the hagiography on the Ben Yishchai. The Art Scroll book I didn't see. There's been about 5 books that appeared in the last 2 years about Rav Ovadia. But I'm not interested in those because Rav Ovadia's grandson, that's the book I use as the basic text. Sassoon has a very nice book and has all the details, and then the rest I take out of the responsum. So hold on, Shlomo, for next class. If I miss anything or something interesting, I don't know what you mean by strange, you can pass it on to me. If you're asking me, the strange stuff is not in the middle years. The strange stuff comes in the more recent years. I mean, the years we're going to speak about, Rav Ovadia used to go to Yom Ha'atzmaut barbecues, all sorts of things. But we'll get to that beginning next class. Good night, everyone.